This is Games as a Podcast, hosted by Chris and Ethan. We're two Sega alums that love talking about the past, present, and future of games, and the industry that makes them. Each week, we explore a gaming topic,
often mixing in our perspectives from our time at Big Blue and beyond. And some weeks, we'll have a guest, usually someone whose career has crossed ours. We talk about their own experiences and perspectives as well.
Today, we're super excited to be joined by Mary Casey. We both worked with Mary at Sega, where she fearlessly helped shape our product management team and stepped in as studio head. She's since gone on to ship many games, wonderful games, and has a raft of experience and a razor-sharp wit. She's a great storyteller. Really appreciate you joining, Mary. Thanks for your time.
No worries. Hi.
Do you want to tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I think I can finally say I'm a lifelong game maker. Started out in AAA, making some, like, kind of, I don't know, maybe some classic games that people have taken on a life of their own. Blur was one of the major ones, which is apparently a really big viral hit in Israel and Turkey, so that's cool.
Hey, I liked it in the US.
I know. There's like a big internet cafe game now. I thought that was really funny. I then moved to do a bunch of like social games. I worked on Mushy Monsters. I worked on just like loads of like just stuff. Xbox Live games, online games. I moved to the US to work with you guys, which is so fun. Got to have a dream, work on Sega titles, work on some Sonic stuff, which was really exciting. And then I went to Warner Brothers. I worked on a lot of different stuff there, but I'm really focused on Harry Potter and kind of building out their new kind of strategy for various different games. We started off with kind of, you know, just testing the waters with a hidden object game and then rolled up through Harry Potter Wizards Unite. And then I was at Meta working on VR, social VR, but also just experiencing stuff in VR like sports, etc., and avatars and just a bunch of crazy stuff. And then, yeah, I left Meta for a little bit to make my own stuff. Then went back to Meta to make more stuff. And then now I'm just drifting around. I'm doing a lot of consulting work. I've got my own little startup just kind of growing every day. And so, yeah, still just making games, which is remarkable, really. It's been a while.
Yeah, that's a crazy journey. I do remember, Mary, you saying you worked on Hatoful Boyfriend as well.
Yeah, so Hatoful Boyfriend is a really funny one. So Mediatonic, creative director, Paul Croft, is like a really wonderful person. That team went on to make Fall Guys. So if you look at something like Fall Guys or Hatoful Boyfriend, that's Paul in like a nutshell. So him and one of our producers, Ed Fear, were like, reached out to the creator of Hatoful Boyfriend and were like, hey, can we bring this pigeon dating simulator to the UK and bring it to the English market? Because it had only been in Japanese up until that point. And she was just such a wonderful, cool person, single developer. And she was like, yeah, totally you can. And you can add an extra pigeon dating scene and all that good stuff. So when I say during that time, I like worked on a bunch of that was just like a bunch of stuff we were working on, like, I mean, Mediatonic don't think it had a regular game the entire time I was there. And when they finally launched Fall Guys and it became such a success, it looked like such a culmination of 10 years of like being a really silly studio, finally made the perfect silly game.
Well, it must have been really exciting to work in a space where you could just try anything, where really creative ideas could come to the fore and actually be tested out. Because that's hard to make happen now. And it was even hard when we were all working together.
Yeah. I don't think I'll ever get to work anywhere like that again, and particularly during that period of time as well. I think about we were doing so many pitches. So we were pitching new IP. We were pitching on existing IP. We were, you know, trying to create and self-publish stuff, which we did at times too. And the nature of indie game at the time was really, really booming because we were kind of in the post, you know, 2008 era. So people were really buying indie games like Super Meat Boy, etc., in like actual amounts that you could sustain a studio of more than like three people. So Mediatonic were going through a lot of growth. We were making a lot of stuff, and yeah, it was fun. We had a lot of game jams. It was genuinely like a fun, silly, ridiculous place to work. Yeah, it's good. You know, when you want to go home again, I'd love to go home again to that period of time, because I think it's when you think about what game making is like, a lot of my kind of real memories of it are from kind of that like ridiculous period.
Yeah, I can clearly remember the time when Sega was looking really closely at the Xbox Live Arcade space. And when Super Meat Boy came out, yeah, that and Limbo and these other titles that really broke out and got big, we started putting some real investment into that. Do you remember Renegade Ops or Hell Yeah or Sonic the Hedgehog 4 Episode 1 and 2? Some really cool stuff that came from that. I do remember the creative director at the time saying Sega's doing that because they haven't failed there yet.
yet.
And that was an interesting way to look at the strategies being deployed. But it was a really cool time because you had these smaller scale games for like $15 a pop, and they were as good as anything you ever bought on a Super Nintendo, right? Yeah, and the same breadth of content, and that was a sweet spot. It didn't last forever, but I do remember in particular bringing some of Double Fine stuff, The Cave, mm-hmm. in particular, over and being pretty proud that we had picked that one up. But yeah, and Mediatonic, that really was an interesting company for sure.
Yeah, we made everything from like a brawling, side-scrolling, theater-based game. We had a musical Day of the Dead band thing at one point. I still can't get that Eurythmics song out of my mind from Robot Unicorn Attack. We had Amateur Surgeon Hospital running. We had a Disney MMO for kids with all the like IP in it. And that's where I first heard about Zendaya. She was in that really early MMO.
That's crazy. Well, do I remember correctly that you worked on a project that included Megan Fox as well?
Oh, yeah. No, that was Activision. Yeah. It's lovely, by the way. She's nice. She's really, really... She was always really professional and always really nice. I don't think we ever had a problem with her. So I think she has a look that makes you think that she might be like diva-ish or anything like that, but she was not at all. She was really great.
That's fantastic. Yeah, well, I didn't have many chances to work with anyone that would be considered a celebrity. I do remember working on Charlotte's Web, and the boy who did the voice for Wilbur the Pig was super nice, but he was a little robot. Like, he had been so trained how to talk to adults that it seemed almost mechanical. And then I also...
Good little acting monkey boy.
Yes. And I remember one of the strangest likeness issues we had was the PC version of that game had cutscenes from the movie. And the big rule was that you couldn't use Dakota Fanning in anything. We didn't have the permission to do that, which is fine. But then there was one clip that Paramount said, no, you can't move forward with this clip in it. And I'm like, what are you talking about? They said, well, you can see a little bit of Dakota Fanning's leg in the shot. And that counts. You can't use that footage.
Wow.
So, yeah. Always interesting when personalities are brought into games. And I think it can work. Chris, I think you said you recently played through the DLC for Cyberpunk, right?
I haven't played the DLC, actually. No, I've just played the entire game.
Oh, okay.
I haven't checked out the DLC yet.
Well, there too, Keanu Reeves is great. I was thinking about Idris Elba, who's also fantastic in the DLC. But it's been interesting to see personalities that we're familiar with on the big screen actually have a meaningful impact on games.
Well, he's Keanu's now Shadow the Hedgehog, isn't he?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
So it goes both directions. But actually that
full circle
kicks me off to wanting to talk really quickly about a game I've been playing and loving this week, because it's bringing Harrison Ford back without using his voice or any motion capture. He's not in it at all, but sure feels like it does have him. And that's Indiana Jones and the Great Circle.
I'm not sure what a motion capture of Harrison Ford at his age would look like anyways.
Fair enough. But it is just an absolutely fantastic game, and the voice actor that is playing Harrison Ford sounds just like him, which is really impressive. It's the same voice actor that did Joel in The Last of Us. Mm. He did the Joker in Batman Arkham Origins. It's like he's a chameleon. This game just feels so authentic. The sound effects in the game are absolutely incredible. So when you hear the punches or the whip, it sounds just like you remember it being from the movie. It's just this authentic, lived-in experience. Like, you feel like you are Indiana Jones. And Mary, you said you've had a chance to dive into a little bit, right?
You know, Indiana Jones is one of my favorite IPs, right? It's right in the heart of like my childhood, just like watching those movies at Christmas. So I think it's really, really well done. And it's fun. And I don't think we've really had this thing of capturing that feeling of being in character like that for a really long time. I think the first time I played Arkham, and you're like 5 minutes into it, and you're like, oh yeah, no, I'm Batman now. I don't know who else thought they were Batman, but it's actually just me. And I think they do the really the same thing really, really, really well. And we've kind of gotten, it's almost like an old school mechanic there. Like this idea that you are embodying in character, you're fully being that character. It's like a, one shot story, but that is not a mechanic that we see very often anymore. This like true single player experience. So it's always nice to kind of return to like that, like fully immersive, like character driven, like story, and for it to be fun along the way too. It's just a big bonus.
So does it feel kind of like an Uncharted game? Because I always feel like Uncharted is basically trying to be Indiana Jones, or at least tell a story like Indiana Jones and kind of have that same kind of vibe. Is that a mischaracterization?
That's what you'd expect, isn't it? Or for it to feel like Tomb Raider, which itself is very similar to Uncharted and clearly inspired by Indiana Jones. This one's in first person, and I think that's a really interesting choice because it breaks with the convention that you'd expect, but it really does make it feel more like you are Indiana Jones. And also, one thing that I've always had a hard time with Uncharted, kind of a cognitive dissonance, I guess, is where you're this charming roguelike hero that is also a mass murderer. Like he kills hundreds of people in those games, right? And it's fun, and you let it go while it's going. But what's really interesting about the Indiana Jones games, this one in particular, is you have access to a gun, but you almost never use it. It's almost all punching people until they're knocked down, which is much more in character. And when you're solving puzzles, that you actually hear Troy Baker, again, the voice actor, doing his Indiana Jones, talking his way through it just like he does in the movies. And that just also feels really good. The pacing is just a really excellent mix of the puzzle solving and the action, and a real sense of exploration that I think is better than what you get in Uncharted. It feels like you're in a real place.
I think that essentially what they've done is they've just really run with the idea of embodiment. So they've said, look, we're just going to put you in their hands. And it works really seamlessly, I think, partly because it's such a well-known trope. I mean, obviously, it kind of created the trope in many ways, Indiana Jones, but this idea of if there's a thing, you need to get the thing. There are puzzles and things along the way. Like, it's such an easy thing that you slip into the embodiment super easily. You don't have to like reorientate yourself in a new paradigm. You don't have to think about the idea that things are going to be different or function differently. It's very much like, here's you. You feel very grounded immediately. You get a whip in your hand. There's stuff in front of you, and then you just go at it. And I think that's one of the things where they've gone, okay, like, we know that these things are well understood, so we can push in these areas. And I think they've just done this idea of like, how do we make you really feel at the center of this adventure rather than in Uncharted in particular, for me, you are like a third party detached camera. It's meant to be cinematic, even in the way the camera pans, etc. It's not a one-to-one embodiment. It's a cinematic moment and kind of more akin to watching an experience, whereas this feels a little bit more visceral. And I think Ethan's right, because you're not shooting anything at a distance and you're using your fists and stuff a lot. Like up close, you get that heavier feeling of kind of weight, which helps with that kind of one-to-one embodiment. It definitely does exactly what it says on the tin. It's like, do you want to be Indiana Jones for like 5 hours? There you go. Done.
Yeah, the writing is very good too. It's just a really well-told story with very solid acting. It feels cinematic in the way I want an Indiana Jones experience to feel. So the cutscenes are just a delight. It's really fun to watch the characters get to know each other, slowly start to trust each other, and it does feel like interactive cinema to me.
Yeah, I think that last bit is really true. I think it's one of those things where you could almost give it to anyone at this point. Like, you could give that game to a lot of different people and they would understand it and get it and want to play it. And the barriers to entry on it are fairly low.
So, Mary, that actually brings up something interesting to me, the idea of putting it in someone's hands, and obviously it's on Game Pass, so hopefully a lot of people can play it and it feels free to them. But I wonder how many people actually will, because the challenge with the brand is that it hasn't been rebooted or maintained as consistently as something like Star Wars. So I had a friend that worked at LucasArts, and they always said that Star Wars was the big brand that everyone knew and loved. And Indiana Jones, there was an audience that would now be in their late 40s, early 50s, that absolutely love him. But younger audiences are indifferent to the character. So I wonder, when you look at most gamers are in their like late 20s, early 30s, I believe, like, you know, the ones that are enthusiast players that'll really try anything. I love the Indiana Jones game. I think it's my second favorite game of the year behind Astrobot. But again, I'm just about to turn 50. I was 14 when Last Crusade came out. I'm in that perfect sweet spot, and I love that character. I went to see all of his movies in theaters. But if you look all the way back to Raiders of the Lost Ark, which, of course, this game heavily references, especially in the beginning, that movie was 1982. So how many elderly gamers are out there that are just eagerly gobbling up this game versus something like Marvel Rivals, which I think, you know, is designed for an audience that is a lot younger?
This is the thing, right? I played, like, not that much, maybe an hour, 90 minutes. The likelihood of me returning is low.
Okay.
And I think that that's just the whole point, is it a great game? Yes. Did I really enjoy it? Yes. Will I get enjoyment out of every single hour of it? Probably. Do I have like 5 jobs and a kid and
yeah,
8 million other things going on? Yes.
You have the other kid too.
I know. Well, I mean, like, he's 11. He's pretty self-sufficient. I'll say. Just for himself. Eats a pot noodle, has some toast, gets himself to bed. No, I'm just joking. He's at a friend's house. I think the thing that we find about these single, solo, one-player games is that other than the sheer enjoyment of the storyline or the game itself, there's very little pulling you back through now. So, like, if I wait a year or 2 years, the experience is very similar. Whereas if I want to play something like Marvel Rivals, it feels much more like a social bandwagon to jump on. There are people playing, there are people leveling, there are people doing stuff. The game is moving on while I'm standing still. So the
FOMO is real.
Yeah, the FOMO is real, yeah. And the wanting to be part of it is real, and the wanting to have the conversation is real. Like, we can have a conversation about, as we just have about Indiana Jones, and never speak of it again, because the game will never change. One of us just might finish it. And so the problem with it is that on the priority stack rank, it starts to fall. And I think that's with me being, like, you know, again, like, in my 40s, perfectly available for this type of game. The, you know, someone who watched the movie, who knew about it, blah, blah, blah. Now, if we start to go, okay, cool, like, now you don't have any attachment to the IP. Yes, it's a great game, but the push to start it, to try it, like, I just wonder where that impetus is. It's like, in a world of choice, like, what is attracting people to it?
Yeah.
At a $70 price point too, right?
Right.
If you don't have Game Pass. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Who has Game Pass? This is the question. Like,
yeah.
I have Game Pass, you have Game Pass, Chris has Game Pass. But, like, who has Game who really has Game Pass in the grand scheme of, like, Game Pass? Like, I know that, like, my kind of gamer brother has it, but, like, my sister, my nieces, like, it's not a subscription that people have. And also, I think it's going to be one that people might start to cut.
Yeah.
You know, as money gets tighter and the economy gets however it's going to get.
Not only that, but you have the same challenges that you do in the television and film streaming solutions, where Ubisoft wants their own platform. EA wants their own platform. So yes, EA Play, you can get the old EA games on Game Pass, but not the new stuff. You got to subscribe to EA service to get the new stuff. And so that, again, creates the situation where just having Game Pass, if you really want to play all the games, is not going to be enough. You'll have to get some at retail or digitally at a premium price point, or subscribe to multiple services. Now, one thing I wanted to talk about a little bit here, it's interesting to look at Marvel Rivals and Indiana Jones releasing on the same week, and specifically looking at how games journalism is covering these. So I did a little bit of digging. Indiana Jones has an 87 on Metacritic, so it's one of the best games of the year from a review perspective. The Marvel Rivals game has a 74 Metacritic, still very good. What's really interesting is that there are 124 professional Metacritic reviews for indie and 23 for Marvel Rivals. And then on the flip side, when you look at something like Twitch, there's 20K people today watching Indiana Jones and 69K watching Marvel Rivals. And then Marvel Rivals got 10 million players. That's not concurrent. That's a collective, but still pretty astonishing. Where you look at the data for Indiana Jones is a little tough to come by because it, you know, Game Pass is kind of a black box, but you're looking at something like 12,000 concurrents or something like that on Steam. So something significantly lower for Indiana Jones. So I just think it's really interesting that you have kind of this Twitch audience that's embracing Marvel Rivals. You have the editorial audience that is embracing Indiana Jones. And it feels like there's a bit of a split. I will say myself, I still find journalists super valuable and Metacritic super valuable because it connects with what my interests and tastes are. I almost never play multiplayer games. I'm almost exclusively single player. That's what they tend to focus on. That's what's valuable to me. But I think that kind of journalism is an increasingly niche thing where it does resonate for people like me that grew up with IGN and GameSpot and Electronic Gaming Monthly. But I wonder how relevant it is for the broader audience now.
Yeah, I think it's hard to compare the titles. They're different business models and they're different audiences. There's a reason why it's popular on Twitch because it's a multiplayer game and it's fun to watch because it's visually, there's a lot going on. And I think it's also hard to look at the numbers on Twitch because the different publishers are going to spend differently for influencer mindshare, basically. So I would assume NetEase is spending a fair amount of money to have prominent streamers playing it, which can obviously have a market influence on the number of people viewing at a given hour. Also, I think there's not a lot of reviews because I think sometimes reviews for free-to-play multiplayer games ship after the title launch because people want to spend some time with it before they can kind of weigh in on it. So it doesn't really surprise me that there's a ton more reviews of indie than Marvel Rivals. As far as journalism goes, I think it's interesting for me as I get older. I think word of mouth is a much bigger thing for me than reading reviews. I will always go to Metacritic to get kind of a baseline, but I'll usually play something based on my own personal taste and or a recommendation from a friend, which I think is the number one thing for gamers of even the younger generation.
I just can't imagine a critic being able to review Marvel Rivals correctly.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Look, I just think it's impossible to do. Whenever you have a significant component of something really being created in outside the game by players, and in this case, the meta of like who is a good, you know, what teams work, who works where, what strats, the loadout yep. should be, all of that stuff. Like, unless you're part of like that community, it's almost impossible to understand even what's happening in the game itself. I am not surprised that people have reviewed Indiana Jones. It's an easy thing to review.
Yep.
Like, you can play it, you can make pretty objective statements about what in it is good and what in it is bad. And you can pretty accurately define whether or not it stacks up to what we classically think of as a good game. Like, is it worth $70? Question. But the interesting point of it is that for the $70 you pay, you know exactly what you're going to get. Like, you know roughly how long you're going to spend in it. You know the quality level it's going to be at. You know you're going to have a good time. When we talk about something like Marvel Rivals, like, the experience that you can face in a game like that, depending on your level of interest in any of the things in it and your social group and what you get drawn into, your experience in it can be so vastly different. And, like, it takes so long, I think, for games like that to really reveal themselves and become something that you either are really going to connect to or not. That for me, it's one of those things of, can all the hype, the streamers and the air and the noise around the game, like, sustain it through to it finding its like rhythm of who are going to be its core players. So to me, it's kind of just like two different things, two different games aimed in two different ways to accomplish like two different things.
Shipping Marvel Rivals is day one versus shipping indie and you're walk away, you know.
We used to get 3 weeks off, remember? We used to ship a game. If you guys remember this, we used to ship a game and get 3 weeks off. You could just go, like, chill out for a month, and then, you know, you'd be back to work on normally the sequel of what you were previously working on. But, like, it was very much a case of, like, you know, we delivered the release, the RC1 candidate to the right people. We got the number of points we needed to get was under the threshold of which Sony kicks you out, so they approved it. And then Nintendo of Japan approved it, so it's being sent to Nintendo of America for the last minute stamp. So in all that period of time, like, you weren't doing anything.
Yeah.
You're just waiting for things. Whereas, like, the Marvel Rivals team are, like, you know, those guys are gearing up for the fight of their lives, essentially, to kind of get this game afloat while all the headwinds are going in the right direction. Because otherwise, you know, they're going to struggle. But, I mean, they've had a great, great, great launch with a lot of buzz. Game is fun. It's fun to watch. So I think they've really pulled it off. But, you know, time's only going to tell with that game.
I'm enjoying it.
I've watched a ton of it. I haven't played it yet, but it looks great. It plays so well. The characters look awesome. I love the character designs. It's a real breadth of roster, like loads of classic comic characters. I love their looks. So, you know, like, I think they've nailed a bunch of stuff.
And Chris, I'd love to know, you've said you liked it. Like, what is great about it? What are you enjoying most?
Well, it is visually stunning. It really, they've hit it out of the park from a visual fidelity standpoint. The maps are pretty fun. They're engaging. They've added destructible bits, which plays into strategy, which is kind of fun. It's really fun to play as superheroes or villains from the Marvel universe. It's fun to play with that IP. I think anyone who's enjoyed Overwatch should at least give it a try. I think some may be tempted to dismiss it as just an Overwatch clone, but there are some mechanics that are different. The map destruction elements, for one, you also have this ability to team up. So if I'm Spider-Man and there's a Venom on my team, there's certain kind of superpower type things that you can do. So Groot can carry a rocket on his shoulders. There's some interesting team ups there. There's also a huge variety of characters. Like Mary said, there's 33 at launch, which is a huge amount. So I think there's something familiar that you want to play. If you come from Overwatch, there's certainly analogs for different heroes, but there's also something that's completely different. So if you want to try something that does not play like any of the Overwatch heroes, you absolutely can do that. So it's fun. I guess at the end of the day, I just enjoy getting in there and battling it out. I don't think the music is great. It's kind of butt-rocky, especially the opening theme. And I do wish there was a first-person mode. I understand why it's third-person. I hope they add a first-person mode. I personally would like that better, but I know that they want to sell more skins and monetize it more highly, and I think people will enjoy being able to see their cool costume from a third-person vantage point. Other than that, it's great. They're off with a bang, and hopefully they will be able to tune their way to success and find a nice audience.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at that and compare it to something like Suicide Squad. And I know that they're different because, you know, one is PvE, one's PvP, but both are superheroes, right? And there was a lot of cynicism going into Suicide Squad, I think in great part because it was upfront paid. But people seem to be very excited about Marvel Rivals in a way that I bet Rocksteady really wish people were excited about Kill the Justice League. I'd love to know from both of you, why do you think there is that distinction? Why was one, like, embraced so warmly and the other one people were cold on?
You could chalk it up to Marvel versus DC. Some degree, I think Marvel IP has a much broader appeal than DC's IP, just generally speaking. Free-to-play certainly helps, and I do think styling it after Overwatch was probably smart, because I think some people can be very intimidated about starting a new game, but if they understand that it's kind of like Overwatch, then maybe they're a little more comfortable getting into it.
Yeah, makes sense.
I mean, I worked on DC Legends for a long time. I think it's interesting from my perspective, like, the difference between the two. I think one thing to say is that with Rocksteady, you're getting a different style of game than the game that they really became famous for. And I think that's always a difficult transition to make in kind of the minds and eyes of gamers who have really enjoyed something. But I do think that something that it's important to remember is that even though they're very similar IPs, they are or have been going in different directions. You know, Marvel has been attempting to widen its base, particularly after the post-Disney acquisition. We're seeing, you know, more things for younger people. We're seeing, you know, everything all up and down the chain in terms of kind of getting these character recognition out there. So the fact that they can do 33 characters that people recognize is massive. And then we say, yeah, they have borrowed from Overwatch. One of the things I think they have massively borrowed from Overwatch is the shine, and it just being exceedingly chromey and shiny and pretty. It is the look that is just really appealing. It seems fast, it seems modern, and I think a lot of people really like to see that and see those bright colors. I think DC, and particularly with the Arkham style of DC, that's pretty much the opposite. It's one of the more hardcore versions of the DC universe. And then when you put on top of it that's kind of like it's Kill the Justice League, there's a lot of like stuff that happens in the Arkham universe or in that universe with those characters that, you know, people might not necessarily, particularly if you're very casual about comic book characters, you know, I don't want to see the Joker kill Batman. Might just be a thing that like people feel like, and actually I want my 1980s version of Psylocke looking cool with go-go boots on. And, you know, like, I don't think that's wrong. It's just two very different styles, and one is obviously going to appeal to many more people, and it's going to be free to play, and, you know, there's going to be something for everybody there.
It could also be a timing thing in terms of tastes, you know, dark and gritty. I think Game of Thrones maybe brought a little more open minds to kind of gritty and dark type themes, but that was decades ago, so maybe the taste kind of changed, and maybe some of it is just time, market timing, and about what people's tastes are or what they're willing to kind of experience at a given time.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Post-COVID as well.
Yep.
I don't know how many people want to return to like really dark universes, and how much people are looking for things that, you know, just a little more fun and exciting. And if you're going to get escapism, maybe escape somewhere pretty and retro and nostalgic, rather than somewhere gritty.
That looks like the real world.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You're describing, I think, the game that you played this week that we were talking about before the show started, Mary.
What, Bellatro?
Astrobot.
Astrobot, yeah. Astrobot is so pretty and lovely and nostalgic and retro, and you just want to stay in there forever. It's a lovely world.
And tactile. It's so tactile. Like, what they do with the controller just feels so good. It's like, you know, just a little pitter-pat of his feet, and you can feel that as it's going, the sound effects that pop from the controller. I think that's a huge part of it. It's like, that game feels more immersive to me than anything I played in PSVR 2, honestly.
Wow.
And it's just, it's very clever design and really using that controller in a unique way. Now, I don't know if you can keep the sound effects on, because I know sometimes that disrupts family, especially if a little one is sleeping. What's your feeling been on the use of the controller in the game, Mary?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those things where you can tell that it was originally built to take advantage of the controller, right? So it uses every single aspect of it, from kind of like the rumble to the sound effects to everything else in it. To me, it's like all of those little things, they're just really contributing to the idea that the bot has weight, and that weight changes. And as soon as they've nailed that, everything else just feels so much more immersive. You feel like you're pulling on things, you feel like you're sliding on stuff. Like when you said like it felt more immersive to you than anything you've played in PS, you know, VR, to me, like, I'm almost convinced this is all about this feeling of like physics and groundedness and weight and your ability to kind of orient yourself inside of a new paradigm. As soon as you, humans are like trained to understand like how an object falls, like babies drop stuff off the side of their high chair. Like, it's important for them to understand about weight and how things fall and physics and movement. And I think that's just one of the things where if you don't have to teach players that, if your game like can copy it one-to-one from real life, and you can use like digitized stuff to make it feel that way, like, you're just off to the races. It's kind of one of the reasons why I like Call of Duty, because each of those guns like feels like it's shooting, and they have different weight.
Yeah.
And it has like this grounded, really physical feeling to it, whereas like with some other games, they're so light that it doesn't feel as immersive, because you break the idea that the thing that you're controlling has real physics, and then it's a game.
Actually, Stalker 2, I don't know if either of you have had a chance to jump into that yet, but it's a really ambitious game, really amazing that it was made in the Ukraine during wartime. And I admire a lot of what the game's trying to do, but the guns feel insubstantial. They feel like water guns. It doesn't have that heft and satisfying punch that a Call of Duty gun will give you. That's very true. And it's less fun as a result.
Right, exactly. You just don't. Part of that is you don't get the payoff, you don't get the immersion. I keep saying that, like, the VR breakthrough that we need to get through is that you can pick up and throw a ball and you know where the ball's going to land.
Oh, yeah.
Because right now there's, like, literally nothing in VR, like, no game around now where you can pick up an object, it feel like it has heft, and you can heft it, and then it goes where your brain thinks it should go. Until some of those, like, one-to-one paradigms are either solved or we teach you to exist in a world where that can't happen, then VR's always going to feel uncanny.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. The locomotion, I think, is always a huge challenge with VR as well. You really have to get used to whatever the game is trying to do to get you to move. I think one of the more clever solutions there was, I believe it was a Walking Dead game where you were actually in a wheelchair. And so smooth movement made sense. They worked it into the fiction, right?
I mean, that's definitely clever.
But, you know, something like Half-Life Alyx, which I loved. I think that that's the best VR experience I've ever had. I talked to plenty of people that didn't like it because there is such a learning curve to feeling good about just maneuvering in the space. And also they do a thing where you have to reload and it's a more intricate set of movements you have to do, which feels more realistic. And I love ultimately, but it is not as fast and slick as playing in 2D where you just, you know, click the R button and you're reloaded.
Yeah, I think the thing that I find about and that specific point there is that the game doesn't feel like it's designed around the slower. I really enjoyed the game. Like, I loved it. It was great. But I think if you're putting real life paradigms through, then you need to face real life consequences for those things. And I think the problem is that it sits in a place between the 2D and the 3D. So at times it leans into the 3D and at times it leans into the 2D. And so that's where you can get a slight choppiness in your experience of like, oh, I'm doing this gun exactly as I would do in real life, but there's no pace to the gunplay where I would naturally like stop and duck and do this thing and blah, 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 blah. It's still too 2D in its approach to the level design. But at the same time, like, it's like saying, like, this Rembrandt isn't quite right in this corner. It's like not. It's like a huge leap forward for design, and it's incredible and it's brilliant. I want to play it again without remembering anything that happens in it. But those are just things that, you know, VR developers are going to keep working on.
I still think that either Superhot or Beat Saber are the VR experiences that are most organically kind of native to VR that feel really good, that just intuitively you know how to work those things and it feels right.
Yeah, you can hand it to anyone, right? And they'll get it.
Yeah, Superhot in particular is just like, I don't know, it's just so fun. I could play it all day. Beat Saber is one of the things where, this I think is a really great example of where they're using all the paradigms that you know to make it more comfortable for you to be, and they're removing a bunch of stuff that's confusing to you. They're like, hey, actually, don't worry about where the floor is and where your feet are, just don't think about that. Just think about the idea that these boxes are coming towards you and you're going to dance about with a beat. Oh, no, don't think about the horizon. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, we'll give you something to, like, slightly orientate yourself on, but don't really think about depth perception in here. It's not really important. And so it does a really good way of just teaching you, like, oh, yeah, no, it's fine. You're standing on the floor of your living room, so you don't need to worry about what happens in this space. Just wave your arms about. And it's so fun as a result.
Well, and the other thing is that allows you to feel like it's right to be kind of light as a feather in terms of the stuff that you're focused on. What's harder, I worked for a bit in VR as well after my time at Sega, and I worked at a company called Midas Touch Games, and we did a game called Fist of Physics. But ironically, the thing that was so unsatisfying about the game was that it was like a Rock'em Sock'em Robots thing crossed with Godzilla, right? Where you had battles with people and you were, you know, in a cityscape. But everything felt paper thin. It felt so light. There was no sense of weight. And we could never figure out how to give that sense of weight, how to encourage people to punch slowly instead of just move really quickly, which just accelerated that feeling of nothingness or lightness, right? So that was always the difficulty of, like, on paper, it looked like it would be like the perfect application of VR and room scale gameplay. We built it specifically for Vive and room scale. But Mary, I'd love to know the challenges you've seen, everything from like making sure you have at least 90 frames a second to like giving a sense of depth working in VR. There's so many challenges that just don't exist on a flat screen.
Making VR stuff is both really fun because, you know, you have a limited tool set, right? Like there's things you just can't make. Mm-hmm. But also you are essentially saying to somebody, like, forget, you know, however many years you've been alive, of how the universe works. And not in kind of like, oh, the rules are different here and people have green faces. But like up doesn't necessarily mean up, down doesn't necessarily mean down, left doesn't necessarily mean left, and right doesn't necessarily mean right. And so when you put people in these situations and then you go, okay, let's confuse their perspective, like you think that's a wall, we'll take it away and put a beautiful vista on it so you think you can look for miles. So you're deliberately saying to someone's brain, hey, don't trust anything in here, it's all a bit weird. And then you're going, but trust your feet when we make you move. And so from my perspective, it's just this idea of like, how do you both convince a brain that to trust you in an environment that you've built completely, and also to allow you to be so comfortable you have freedom of movement, and then also make sure you don't move, because you can't move, because if you do, you'll fall over your coffee table. Mm-hmm. So it's like this odd combination of things that you want to get together. And then on top of that, we want to say, hey, play a game. And then in our case, because, you know, I work for social VR, we're then saying, and meet people. And hey, you know how we taught you how meeting people online was like lower because, like, you know, you didn't have to worry about like your body positioning and all this other stuff. You could just meet by text and there'd be avatars. Yeah, so we're going to take that out again. And we're going to go, your body language is important and people can hear your real voice. So it's a really interesting one where a bunch of paradigms that you are aware of and know and a bunch of norms that you're aware of and know get thrown out. But then we want to rebuild them back up for you. And with any kind of new like platform like that, it just takes time. And the major issue is always just going to be that it just really takes time to like understand how people like react to each other, to decide how people like come together. And there have been a lot of experiments of, does this work? Does that work? Does a cinema work? Does a sports bar work? Does a town square work? Mm. And then, you know, it's fun you talk about Rock'em Sock'em Robots. We had a VR Rock'em Sock'em Robots in Horizon. There's a test level ones where you kind of get inside the head of a robot and pull some levers and it would, you know, fight the other thing. And it was cool because they were huge. But also you're in VR, so it doesn't matter they were huge.
Right.
So
right.
Like things like start to make sense and then you do something and you're like, oh no. Actually the nature of the platform then devalued what it was. So making stuff that felt VR natural, making stuff that felt like you were experiencing it that you couldn't experience elsewhere. Because that's the thing to me, it's like if you spent the time to put the headset on, and you're going into VR, what you should get there should be an experience you can't get somewhere else.
Yep.
And so that was the thing that was really pulling on me, which was like, how is this better than this experience in 2D? And I think a lot of ideas, like 99% of ideas, get culled at that first stage. Like, well, this would just be better if it wasn't in 3D. And then the ones that make it are really good.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And the experience that I've had, because I'm a VR enthusiast, I bought just about every headset, right? I do know that a Meta Quest 3 is going to be sitting under our Christmas tree this year. The thing is, though, is if I'm looking at something like Assassin's Creed, honestly, it's easier to play that just in 2D. There's lower friction to just turning on my PS5 and playing it that way. However, if you're looking at that social experience that you're talking about, it is less friction for me to put on a headset and go into, for me, it was Altspace VR, mm-hmm. and talk to people, then on a Tuesday night, go out to the local bar, and talk to people, right? The headset is actually lower friction in that case because I want that presence. I want to talk to people who feel like they're really there. I want to have interesting conversations about video games and atheism and all sorts of interesting things that are cool to talk about with strangers, right? Sometimes politics can be fun to talk to strangers about, but you feel more anonymous, but at the same time, more present than you would in a 2D experience. And that social context was valuable to me. I remember when the iPhone X was announced, I was sitting in AltSpace VR in what felt like an iMac screen. And there were hecklers that loved the Android stuff. And there were like true blue Apple fans that were super excited about it. And it was just a really fun experience. And it felt like you were at a bar or again, like at an IMAX theater just to watch, you know, a special event, and was very different than simply streaming it to your television or your computer monitor. And that to me was really cool.
Yeah. I think it's just one of those difficult things where you can have that experience and it can be amazing. And we can provide a lot of spaces for those experiences to happen, but you're ultimately leaving the last 20% to the users. And so what that means is that the predictability of the experience you have is wide. So like you had a great experience in that, and then someone else could have gone into the same thing and then got really badly griefed and it'd be a really negative experience.
Yep.
So I think a lot of what a lot of the developers have been doing are really kind of learning how to create or to design for positive spaces in VR. I think the identity piece is really critical and key, and I'm really happy that like the work that we were doing on avatars has continued, particularly at Meta, because one of the things I really like resonated with was the amount of people that were using an alternative like avatar of themselves or a version of themselves in VR to just lower that barrier to entry of being social and meeting people and being around people. And then for other people, really experiencing a reality as a person that they weren't able to do in real life. And that could be anything from we had emails from people that had who weren't able to socially transition in real life, but were transitioning in VR.
Oh, cool.
And so they were able to try out, who they really were in a VR space without the pressure and sometimes the illegality of being able to do that wherever they were. So when you have a platform that has that potential to literally change someone's lives, to literally improve it, to literally be something that they can't ever be in any other format. Like it means that it's a platform we have to continue to push and invest in. But in terms of what we understand about how to create things in that space, I just think we're just scratching the surface of it. We're still struggling to understand how to create things in there, but I don't see that as a negative or a bad thing. It just means that it's a slightly harder nut to crack, and I think because it has so many proxies with the real world. We didn't create Starbucks overnight. Like if you talk about a place in the community that exists where people can hang out and have meetings and talk about stuff and meet people that they don't already know, and also provides coffee and is a $1 billion business, that didn't come about naturally. That's something that evolved over time. And the design of that is specific and was designed specifically by somebody. We just need time, I think, for some of those things to evolve and for us to understand how people are going to use it. And learning on VR is slower because the audience isn't as large.
Mm.
Like development for iPhone is so fast because you can learn what people like and don't like in a game or an app so quickly because the audience is massive and it's really intersectional. So you have all sorts of different people of all sorts of different types and they use their phone for ages. When you're looking at collecting data or understanding use patterns for VR, it's 250 people all over, over months.
It's an enthusiast demo, right? So
right, exactly. And your audience is not what you think it's going to be. And we're getting feedback from similar groups as opposed to something like the phone, which has hit such mass market that if you get an average on a phone, that's basically the average of humanity.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask a question. The internet has been a seismic change in society for good and for bad. Certainly, a lot of the experiences that are being built in VR mimic some of the things that have been brought to life by the internet. Do you think that anonymity is a negative or a problem that needs to be either eradicated or ameliorated in order for VR, social VR, to not be overrun by you know, 4chan-y type people?
I think the idea of identity needs to be solved, because I think it's important for people to understand, like, what is a real identity and what isn't a real identity, particularly when they really are. It is relatively easy to generally understand what is a real identity online and what isn't. Like, we tend to use usernames when we're not our real identity, and we tend to use our personal name. We tend to understand what platforms, such as, you know, meta-based platforms, tend to use your real name, and then non-meta-based platforms tend to use a username. Like, TikTok tends to use a username, but there's a mix. Facebook tends to be your personal name, your real name. Some people use it, but it's generally, we understand how things work. When we look at something like VR and we talk about social VR, I think that one of the things is it's really unclear where those things lie. Like, if someone is in VR and they're, particularly if they're speaking and their voice roughly matches their avatar, there's a mental trigger that that person is probably who they say they are, or that that's a real identity, but there's no guarantee of that whatsoever. And then if they're standing next to somebody who, you know, has a crazy name and has a crazy avatar, you would just assume that they are probably not like a dinosaur. But the thing is that you just don't actually know that. There's just no, because it's a mixed platform, there's no real kind of understanding of, like, where you would use your real identity, where you would use this identity, where you would use that identity. I spend more hours of the day talking about identity in video games than I do about anything else, if I'm honest with you. And it's a real big part of one of the other projects I'm working on at the moment. And I think for me, I think 99% or a large percentage of people will want to be anonymous or pseudo-anonymous in social online VR spaces. And that when people are not that, it will be very explicit. And it will be something that people understand before they undertake it. Like, go in this house, we take off our costumes type thing.
So it's mostly about the safeguards that need to be put into place to ensure that it doesn't devolve?
I think so.
Okay.
One of the things about identity that's really critical is that it's almost like a perma-save, and you can perma-die with your real identity. So if you go into a group of people and you act like a twat and you get kicked out, like, you're kicked out forever.
Yeah.
And, like, that's a critical and important piece of, like, our real identity. And it keeps us as human beings basically on the straight and narrow for the most part. Because if you veer too far off, then people know about it. It goes on your permanent record, right?
Right.
We can Google you and find out the shit that you do. Or people say, don't hang out with Chris, you know.
Dodgy.
I think it's important that most people have that ripcord in spaces like online and other virtual spaces. I think people, either whether they understand it or not, want the ability to delete that and walk away from it. And I think it's an important part about psychological safety and being able to say the things you want to say online is that you are anonymous or pseudo-anonymized. So.
Okay.
So, Mary, I saw on LinkedIn you were talking about, I presume, some of the grognard neckbeards that were upset that Witcher 4 has a female lead, which is absurd because I think that is one of the coolest trailers I've ever seen, and I can't wait to play that game. I think some of my concern is when folks like that have anonymity, they can use it in really damaging ways. There's no way around it. You know, I wonder if they would behave the way they do if it was not anonymous.
I mean, I want to be clear that I made a post that basically said, there's a picture of Siri, and I was like, hey, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Play the game or don't play the game, but I don't want to talk about it. How many people do you think have either messaged me to talk about it or aggressively tried to start talking about it in my comments or have found me on another platform to talk about it?
A lot.
What do we think that number is?
And it's interesting because of the platform. Let's think about that, too. This isn't X.
This is a platform with LinkedIn, where everybody has their actual name and where they work. And all of the people, how many people do we think, how many people do think have messaged me or aggressively tried to argue with me about that? Do we think that that number is more, I'm not that popular on LinkedIn. I got like 30 likes, okay? Like
15.
Not that many.
I'll say 2.
Okay, so the correct number is somewhere between. It's 8 separate people.
That's, well, and again, you times that by 10 if you were on X doing that, right? So,
like, I think it's important to remember that, like, people's real names do not stop them in any way, shape, or form.
I guess that's true.
And it doesn't make a difference to the people. Some of those people, I think, which is really key, is that they want to convince you. One of the people is just like, look, I don't think you understand that, like, it breaks my immersion if I have to play as a woman. And it's nothing to do with women or any of that, but I'm a man and it breaks my immersion to play as a woman. So I sent back, what about my immersion?
Yeah.
Like, I've had to play 3 games as, like, a guy with a beard.
Yep. Like,
what? Is it my turn to not have my... If this is true, if this is a true thing, that you can, that your immersion is automatically broken if you are not playing as, you know, your gender assigned at birth, then tell me why I have to put up with it, but you don't have to put up with it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so much of that is just this incredible idea. It's like outrageous righteousness. Like, this is mine. It belongs to me. It is for me. And those people don't think what they're doing is in any way, shape, or form wrong. Except someone is going to say to me, of course they do, because otherwise they would post it publicly, and they don't. They, like, find ways to... They pull my email out of, like, some weird old thing, or, like, and they message me on my old emails from, like, years ago or whatever. It's a funny one because it's, to me, it's just like, it all starts with play the game or don't play the game.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes people so angry.
Yeah, well, people like to get angry. And unfortunately, the platforms kind of amplify the anger. And I feel like it's gotten worse since November, sadly. So it's probably going to be more of the new normal, annoying normal. I'm sorry you had to go through that.
I mean, don't worry about it. I knew when I posted it was going to be funny. Like, I figured it would just be...
I know you can handle yourself too, so it's not a...
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't worry me in the slightest, but it's just one of those things where you're like, I think people think, especially if you haven't, like, you don't have it yourself, that it's like a small minority of people that do this occasionally. It isn't.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of people that do it a lot and who seek it out and who try and find it and who live off it and who breathe off it and whatever. And it's totally fine. It's just one of the things to me of just like, hey, like, actually, it would be really great if people understood that the way that we make decisions is not how they think we make decisions at all, and that actually, like, we're just all good people trying to make a good...
For sure.
And no one's trying to do any of that stuff.
So, Mary, you said this exists even when people have their identities out on the open on a LinkedIn. But I would kind of counter that on the likes of, like, a 4chan where people are anonymous, it's orders of magnitude worse or different. Or so I do think that there is something to be said for consequences. And I think when people are hiding behind the cloak of a username that obfuscates your true identity, people feel they behave differently. And I understand and I guess agree with the tenets of people want to try on different things in the online sphere, and so they should feel safe to be anonymous. I do think there needs to be some safeguards for consequences being tied to actions and or language. Otherwise, VR will become or could become like 4chan, and that's just not a place that a lot of people will want to be because it's not fun.
No, absolutely. I'm already seeing, like, people facing things such as, like, virtual sexual assault in VR.
Yeah.
I think when we talk about anonymity, there's a lot of different types, and something like pseudo-anonymous would mean that you would be anonymous outwardly facing, but not anonymous to the platform holder. The problem you start to get into with some of that stuff is that, one, scale, and then two, you're beholden to what the platform holder determines as problematic. And we've seen from something like X that what the platform holder determines as problematic is a political issue or, like, a regulatory issue more than it is, like, an ethical issue, right? Like, we could determine what would, like, be ethical guidelines for society relatively easily, but the platform holder is ultimately the person that's going to either prioritize or not prioritize that, because everything comes at cost. And then secondarily, they're going to be the ones that decide how and why those rules are upheld or not upheld. And I think that's where we kind of get into a bunch of these kind of, you know, rabbit holes, is that in an ideal world, you would be able to be safe in VR at all times. The problem with it is that that definition of safe is so wide, and because you're beholden on the idea of a platform holder to uphold it, that like the guarantees are just almost basically not there. So then we move into, if we can't safeguard, we have to do the opposite, like moderation and reporting, make sure reporting works, that there are real consequences, that there are strike laws, that there are all sorts of things to get people off the platform. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes a bit easier with headsets because they have a unique address and things like that. But, you know, why can't we just be nice to each other by default?
Yes, so say we all, right? You know, VR is virtual reality, so the unfortunate truth about reality is that it's not necessarily all roses and pleasantries.
Yeah, I think what can be most challenging is if people kind of self-sort into categories where they're like-minded people interested in talking about topics that are relevant to them, that works. But I think what I at least saw in all space VR, which is a little disturbing, is you'd have griefers that would come in that would deliberately go into spaces that they're going to be creating a lot of friction and upsetting people because that's fun to them. And that's such a hard thing to sort. And that ruined a number of experiences that I had in there. A lot of very good experiences. Overall, I liked it. Well, hey, one thing I really wanted to touch on with the both of you, I've been looking forward to this conversation to talk, just to shift gears a bit, about the announcements at the Game Awards. Because let's be honest, the Game Awards is really more about the announcements and the ads than it is about...
It's a bunch of trailers with some awards sprinkled in.
Yeah. But I think
there are rules.
There are.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is this year, I do think as far as the announcements, they did knock it out of the park. I don't think they've ever had such a strong number of announcements, both things that we were hoping to see and actually did, and things that we didn't know we wanted, and brands coming back from the dead. It really, really impressive. And we talked a little bit about Witcher 4, but that to me was the one that excited me the most. Like, that is something I've been so eager to get my hands on.
It wasn't the thing I was most excited by, but it was definitely a very impressive trailer, and I am looking forward to it. I'm a bit of a Naughty Dog fanboy, so Intergalactic was the one that did it for me. I think Naughty Dog, they're so cinematic in their design, and just what that trailer is, I'm so excited about it. It's got such a cool retro pseudo alien-esque aesthetic, and I can't wait to play it.
Yeah, and Naughty Dog is the IP. That's what's so cool. It's like they're big enough to where just that name was enough to say this will be huge.
Yeah.
I have this thing that I just like can't get excited for anything sci-fi. Like, I just have to wait until it's out, because I just feel like whenever a developer, even a beloved one, takes on sci-fi, it's either amazing and we get Mass Effect, or it's the worst thing.
It's a tough one, because space literally is a void. So there are some challenges about how do you travel in that world, the universe, that in a way that feels good and isn't boring or dreadfully boring or takes you out of the immersion. So I agree that it is a challenging genre or theme style. But if anyone can do it, I think Naughty Dog will be able to do it.
Yeah.
And what they produce with the trailer is just gorgeous and so fun and really cool. And it's a world I definitely want to be in. It's just like, it's either going to be amazing or it's going to be like weird space.
I would put my money on amazing, personally.
Yeah. I am pretty confident, especially after The Last of Us, that they can spin a good tale that's going to stand out. The one that really struck me also more near term was Split Fiction, the game from the It Takes Two developers, Hazelight.
Yeah.
Because I loved It Takes Two. I thought that was so much fun.
I mean, It Takes Two is so good.
Yeah.
I wasn't excited by the trailer. I'm excited by the idea, another game from these folks, but it was a bunch of kind of co-op mini games kind of threaded together. And from a visual fidelity standpoint, it kind of fell flat to me, but I think it's going to be fun, no doubt about it, just based on the heritage. I wanted to like it more than I did, I guess.
Fair enough. What about the new Pac-Man trailer, the Shadow Labyrinth? too edgy for its own good? An interesting reinterpretation? What do you think?
I'm not ready for edgy Pac-Man. Just not ready for it. I'm just not ready for Pac-Man's goth era. I just am not.
Yeah, I guess you did mention that earlier in Bright and Happy is a little more palatable right now.
But I'm excited by it because at least it's different.
Yeah.
Because I think if someone said to me, hey, here's the Pac-Man IP, come up with a new game, I'd be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, what? I don't even know where to begin. It's like, wagga wagga. Do we need that? Like, what can we keep? What can we get rid of? Like, so, like, I just think it would be one of those things where I'd be like, so just like, but like, I'm excited that someone else has gone, okay, right, we're going to go dark.
I felt like it was like Mad Lib game design or something. Like,
yeah.
Give me a game, Pac-Man, okay. Give me a style. Gothic Dark Souls. It's like, weird.
Yeah.
People like Elden Ring. People like Pac-Man.
Yeah, exactly. I like weird, though. So who knows? Maybe it will be amazing.
It would be much more interesting to me if they announced that it was like from the makers of Limbo or Inside or something like that, or Double Fine. If there was some boutique kind of arty group that was doing it, that would be valuable to me. Mm-hmm. Speaking of surprising development teams tied to games, the Yakuza team working on Virtual Fighter? That was interesting to me. I mean, it makes sense because totally I know some of those guys worked on Virtual Fighter.
Yep.
Yeah.
But that's cool. And the little bit of footage that we saw was enough to get me excited. What about you two?
I mean, I'll play Virtual Fighter all day, every day, so.
Yep. And then Okami 2, that was pretty cool.
Yes, I am looking forward to that. That was a nice thing to look at.
With Kamiya-san. That's the other thing that's important. It's not just re-releasing it with some new team. This is the OG, which is pretty cool, yep, too. And neat that they clearly understood the value of that and having him there in the audience. The Onimusha also coming back was a surprise to me. It's been a long time since we've seen that. I think PS2 was the last time we've seen Onimusha games.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yep. And then the other one that really struck me was Ninja Gaiden Ragebound. I don't know if you've played Streets of Rage 4 or played, what was the other one, the Ninja Turtles Shredder's Revenge, but the .emu guys, just every project feels like a labor of love. It's just beautifully done 2D art, and that is one I am very eager to see come back from the dead.
Of all the IPs I was expecting to see, that was not it. I was really excited to see it, but like, it's just been a while. Like, that has really... It's really coming back from it. Felt like such an like early 2000s blast from the past. So I think that's going to be fun.
Yeah. Well, they did announce also another Elden Ring DLC. And Chris, I know we were talking a little bit before the show about the idea of DLC being nominated for best game. That's a really interesting thing. Last year, Phantom Liberty, the cyberpunk content, got celebrated as best ongoing game, which was kind of a weird place to put a DLC also.
Yeah.
So it seems like they don't really know what to do with these kind of game-sized DLCs. And it's, I think, also hard because just simply saying, just make a DLC category. Well, there aren't that many DLCs. It's not something you see a lot of. But what did you think about the Erdtree DLC being nominated for Best Game?
Well, I think they should pick a lane and stay in it, right? It should have been either an ongoing game to be consistent with Cyberpunk. I think it's important to recognize great work, and certainly the DLC is practically an entirely new game in terms of the breadth of the content. So it should be eligible for awards, but I don't see any harm in creating a new category DLC. If you look at the analogs for TV or film, you have short form, you have running limited series, there's a lot of categories. So the games industry is huge. I don't see any harm in broadening the categories in the awards if they want to be serious about video game award shows or whatever.
Well, and I'll say this much too, something that was notable was all the Game of the Year nominees were all single player games, which is interesting. I mean, I love to see that because that's what I play, but even I can recognize that maybe Helldivers 2 should get a little bit more love, or Destiny had a huge, really momentous expansion pack. Does make me think maybe the market has gotten so big that it would make more sense to have the equivalent of the Emmys and the Oscars, right? Where it's like awesome content like Succession and Game of Thrones is celebrated at the Emmys. It's not a qualitative difference. A lot of that stuff's better than anything you'll see on the big screen, but they are so different in terms of how the products are packaged, the length, you know, the audience. There's plenty of overlap, but they're different enough to where I think I'd almost rather see a live service or free-to-play Emmys equivalent of the awards show, and then something that's more like the Oscars, which is the big pay-up-front single-player games, just because they seem like they're so fundamentally different that even shows like the Game Awards don't know how to smash them together in a way that feels right.
Well, the Golden Globes does both TV and movies together, so there is precedence for that. I question the need for a video games awards. I think, you know, we had some off podcast conversation about award shows and who are they really for. Bifurcating it into live service games and not live service games seems like it would serve the interests of Ethan Einhorn more than anything else. They're built in the same engines. They can be narrative experiences in a live service game. So it's kind of hard to figure out where to draw that line. So you might as well just have them all together, because people do play both of these games, just like people watch TV and watch movies, I guess you could argue. I don't see much value in it personally. Mary, what do you think?
I think the 0-1 effort is completely different from the 1-2 effort. So in my opinion, a DLC is a DLC. It's a season 2. Like, when we talk about Game of the Year, it should be best new game launched that year.
Definitely.
Within the eligibility period. And I don't think it matters to me if it's live service or whatever it needs to be. But I think from my perspective, when we look at the games that have gone in there, we're talking about stuff that's new and fresh and has, like, sometimes genre-defining or genre-breaking up against something that is essentially additional content for something that already exists. Like, yes, Erdtree is huge and deserves all the awards and is great, but, like, what if it was slightly smaller? What if it was half the size? What if it was twice as big? What if instead of it all coming out at once, it came out over 6 months as a season pack? It's just a distribution method at that point. Like, we're literally just talking about different ways in which to distribute content. And so for me, it's like, let's keep Game of the Year to be the game as it launched in the year, and everything else can move into separate categories. Or maybe you just don't need a fucking thing to put on your mantelpiece. Maybe it just being a great thing that went out and loads of people bought it and it's really cool and it's awesome. Like, do we need to include everybody all the time for everything? I just don't know if we do.
Yeah.
Let's just go, hey, these are 6 brand new games that came out this year that were cool and really interesting, and one of them deserves a trophy. And that's fine.
So I have mixed feelings about the awards. The biggest issue I have is I'm someone who plays just about everything, but not even I played everything that was nominated. The Erdtree, I haven't played that content. I simply haven't gotten far enough in Elden Ring to get to that. So how could I reasonably judge based on that list if Astrobot is better than that, if I haven't played all 5? How many people that are voting for these games have played all of the content in any of the categories? I think that you're looking at exceedingly low numbers of people who have actually spent the time to play some of the more obscure games. And so that makes me wonder, it's not like movies. Movies, you can take time to watch the 10 Academy Award Best Picture nominees. And you presume that most people, or hopefully most people, will watch that. But with games, there's just so much you have to invest. Astrobot took me 12, 13 hours to beat because I went and got a platinum on that,
I
right?
I guess it depends on if you think you actually need to finish the content to properly evaluate it. To Mary's earlier point, a game reviewer could probably get a pretty good bead on Indiana Jones playing it for an hour or two, because it is what it is, and you can make a pretty reasoned judgment playing it. You're analog to film. If you're in the Academy and you're voting, there's a lot of films you have to watch. You have to watch all the short form, it's not just 10 films, basically. So you've got all the different categories. There's going to be a variety of different movies. So if you're a member of the Academy, you are watching a lot of movies, or trying to. And I'm sure there's probably people in the Academy that don't watch all of it and they still vote. So in a similar vein, I think the people that are voting for these games hopefully at least touched the game in some form or another before they voted. But I don't necessarily know that is the case, because it is, at the end of the day, there's a bit of PR machination going on behind the scenes in terms of people pushing their own publishers, pushing their own games, and it becoming a bit of a popularity contest.
Yeah, I can see that. I guess for me, I'm saying not so much like, can you get enough out of 2 or 3 hours? I agree you probably can. But the example I was using is I haven't played any of the Erdtree. And so there are certainly going to be examples.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't have to vote on it.
Right. Yes.
That's
but
kind of part of it, though, I think, Ethan. So I'm not a member of however the Games Awards are voted for, but I am a member of BAFTA. And obviously you get access to everything that's submitted for every category.
Yeah.
And it takes months, like it's rolling in months and months and months. Part of how I look at some stuff is my like want to play it. Like if I actually like don't want to play something and it's really low on my list of wanting to play and I can't bring myself to play it, like that definitely affects whether or not I think it should be Game of the Year. And like it's an interesting part of like how you prioritize what you play and you don't play. And I really try and get around a lot of games. And maybe some of them are not long and some I just watch on Twitch or whatever. It's different if I'm shortlisting a category, then I play for hours. But if I'm just in the open categories, I'm just looking at stuff. I do think there's this thing there of like, if your game seems so repulsive to me that even though I play like Truck Simulator, I can't bring myself to load it. It already means that, like, it's not my Game of the Year, which is fine, which is why I get a vote and you get a vote and somebody else gets a vote, because other people are going straight into it. I do think that there's this case of kind of, like, we need to understand that, like, the machinations that happen behind the voting are a lot. There's no coincidence that certain things get featured announcements also tend to win awards. Like,
yeah,
there's
sure.
PR companies make deals, and I'm not saying this is the Board Games Awards, but PR companies 100% make deals with award shows to say, you can announce our new game if we win this prize. And so to me, like, all of that stuff just becomes like, you know, like, what can you trust and what can you not trust? Like, I know those games are good.
Yeah.
All six of those games. It's fine.
Is it any wonder that there are so many Sony trailers?
Yeah. Well, having been in PR and in journalism, I would say it's both not as innocent as the defenders think it is and not as sinister as the skeptics think it is. It's in the middle there. But I understand what you're saying.
It's not in the middle, Ethan. It's sometimes one and sometimes the other. So this is what I think. Like, I don't think it's in the middle. I think it's sometimes either straight up, like, you know, collusion, or it's sometimes just coincidence and that's just the best thing that we love. Like, I've seen a bunch of stuff in the middle, but I've definitely seen a bunch of stuff on one end and I've seen a bunch of stuff on the other. And particularly when I work for big, powerful publishers, like some of the things that they would do were not things that we could get away with when I was in India.
Yeah, yep. No, that's a fair point and a well-articulated argument. I buy what you're saying there for sure. I would say that the other thing I really do love about award season, though, it's less about who's going to win and more I always love personally to come up with my own list and share that and talk about it, because at the end of the year, and it's kind of brought to the fore by these award shows, but like working in the games industry, so often the expectation when you're talking about what is good is you have to factor in how much does it make, right? And what I love is at the end of the year you can finally just talk about what is good in terms of the art, in terms of how did it make you feel? Is it fun to play? And you don't have to think for a second about how much money it did or did not make. That's irrelevant. Games that make tons of money are good. Games that make nothing are good. But it levels the playing field to just talk about, we are all in games because we love games. What are the games this year that came out that remind us of why we're doing what we're doing? And just share that in a joyful way that doesn't have to focus on ultimately who the winners or losers are from a marketplace standpoint.
Fair enough.
So that being said, I would love to know what your games of the year are, just like the number one for you.
I'll go first. Like, it didn't come out this year, but I think it's having a breakout year. I've been playing a ton of Rockstar roleplay, GTA 5 roleplay. You can have experiences in there that you just can't have on any other platform. You can do things that you can't do. In terms of social, I mean, it's absolutely massive. In terms of a lot of what we're talking about, in terms of identity, etc., like, all of that stuff exists in there. and just like playing on different servers, meeting people, and then getting involved in kind of like the ongoing storylines. And yeah, it's really cool. And if you're not a Rockstar Roleplay player, it's definitely worth streaming on Twitch. It's often the number one stream game on Twitch, so easy to find people to watch.
That's very interesting. I have only played Grand Theft Auto 5 like campaign. I've never even played the online mode, but that's
so
interesting.
So Roleplay is not online. So GTA Online is separate, and then GTA Roleplay is a third thing.
Oh, okay. Is it an official Rockstar thing, or is it something done by fans?
So it's originally a fan mod. So yes, in terms. But yeah, there are official and unofficial. But 5M is one of the larger platforms. I'm playing on a couple of different smaller modders and different servers. It's interesting because it's very different from GTA Online. And there's not the driving economy that drives GTA O.
Oh,
it's a roleplay server. So it doesn't operate that way.
Interesting. Yeah, I'll at least take a look on Twitch. I've never heard of it, frankly, but I'll if it's your number one, I'd really want to check it out. Chris, what about you?
Well, my number one game would be a game that came out last year, and that's Baldur's Gate 3. I'm still getting a ton of joy playing that. I'm a budget gamer in that I will flag something on Steam, and then when it goes on sale, I'll buy it and play it. So my queue is long, and I'm okay with not playing the latest shiny. That said, for a game that came out this year, I'll have to say Balatro. I just really loved it.
Balatro!
Such a great game. I know we've talked about it before in past episodes, but it's just, I like to play poker, and it just takes the poker game and turns it on its head and is just so deep. The mechanics are fun. There's nothing bad about it. I've played it for so many hours, and that would probably be my number one for the games that have come out this year. But admittedly, I haven't played a ton of the games that have released this year.
Yeah, but both of those are good choices. And Balatro in particular, I spent a lot of time with this year too. It's hard to put down. Really, really well made. The one for me is Astrobot. I just feel like Team Asobi delivered to me what they love most in the world. And I got a chance to digest that and enjoy it. It just felt like pure joy. It's the first game I've ever platinumed. Have never taken the time to do that before, but I just couldn't get enough of it. And I hope it's successful enough for them to do another one, because it was a team of 60 people, which nowadays is a small team, you know, and it's it just feels like everything came together perfectly. They had enough time to really make something supremely polished. It is, I think, better than Super Mario Galaxy and not quite as good as Mario Galaxy 2. And that is high praise. But I also loved, incidentally, at the award show where they didn't actually say the word Nintendo, but they took the time to say, yes, we are inspired by the Sony platformers, but come on. You know, it's really all about Mario. And I just, you know, I can relate with that so deeply. And that is definitely the game for me.
Yeah, really, really good time to be a gamer right now. There's so much good content. Mary, we really, really enjoyed our time with you. Thanks so much for coming on and talking a little bit about your perspective and your experience. It was a pleasure, and you are welcome back anytime.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me, and have a great rest of the day.
Yeah. Thanks, Mary.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. If, again, as always, if you have any questions, comments, we'd love to hear them.